Cornelia ten Boom was a Dutch clockmaker who worked alongside her father Casper and sister Betsy. Named after her mother, she went by Corrie. In 1922, she became the first woman in Netherlands to be a licensed watchmaker. When World War II broke out, Germany quickly invaded the Netherlands, upending everything. And in 1942, a woman holding a suitcase showed up at their home and disclosed that she was a Jew. The family, already needing to cling to their faith, was now faced with a dilemma of living out their faith and harboring those the Nazis were hunting, or avoiding breaking the law. This encounter prompted the family not only to open up their home to harbour Jewish refugees, but also to retrofit it for them. 2 years went by, and it is estimated that the family saved around 800 Jews until February 1944, where the Ten Booms were arrested and sent to a concentration camp. Corrie was stripped of her dignity, witnessed her father and sister die, and was subjected to all sorts of horror. But Corrie survived, along with her faith, through the end of the war. She later wrote, after having preached a message, she says, quote, "It was at a church service in Munich that I saw him. The former SSS man who had stood guard in the shower door at the processing centre at Ravensbrück. He was the first of our actual jailers that I had seen since that time. And suddenly it was all there, the room full of mocking men, the heaps of clothing, Betsy's pain-blanched face. He came up to me as the church was emptying, beaming and bowing. 'How grateful I am for your message, Fräulein,' he said. 'To think that, as you say, he has washed my sins away.' His hand was thrust out to shake mine. And I, who preached so often to the people of Bloemendaal the need to forgive, kept my hand at my side. Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts boiled in me, I saw the sin of them. Jesus Christ had died for this man. Was I going to ask for more? 'Lord Jesus,' I prayed, 'forgive me and help me to forgive him.' I tried to smile. I struggled to raise my hand. I could not. I felt nothing, not the slightest spark of warmth or charity. And so again, I breathed a silent prayer. 'Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness.' As I took his hand, the most incredible thing happened. From my shoulder, all along my arm and through my hand, a current seemed to pass from me to him, while into my heart sprang a love for this stranger that almost overwhelmed me. And so I discovered that it is not on our forgiveness any more than on our goodness that the world's healing hinges, but on his. When he tells us to love our enemies, he gives, along with the command, the love itself," end quote. Some people deserve our anger, those who perpetrate evil in the most horrific ways, those who violate, take, abuse. But what happens when our justified anger meets the grace of God, like Corrie ten Boom? What if he wants to show mercy to those who are so vehemently against him or us? What if he wants you to be the arbiter of that mercy? What if it's not anger, but pure apathy, a just complete lack of absence of care for those God wants to use us to show love on his behalf? That's this week on A Little Better. Our goal on this podcast is to know Jesus better and, with the power of his spirit, do better, so together we can be a little better. Welcome back to the A Little Better podcast, where we help Christians mature in their faith. And before we get started, I just want to encourage you to subscribe. This will help you just keep up to date with the latest episode when it releases. And today, we're wrapping up our series that we've been on the last few weeks on Jonah, the book of Jonah, on a series called Nineveh. And today we're joined by the Webster Campus Director, my colleague out in Webster, Jason DeGraff. Good to have you back. Yeah. Now, Jason preached the message this week. So in the show notes, you can find the link to view that message. We will be referring to it, though this can stand alone, but it'd be really helpful for you to go and listen back to that message. It was really, really helpful. Jason, you were even pretty critical of Jonah in your message. I think you called him an idiot, which I don't think is necessarily unwarranted. Mm-hmm. And we've been pretty critical over the last few weeks of Jonah, understandably. I wonder if we could shift our view of Jonah to perhaps viewing him more compassionately. Mm-hmm. The more I've been in this series, I'm wondering if Jonah's just doing his best. Mm-hmm. And he might not have done the right thing, but he was doing his best, right? I'm curious if you're to view him as someone who's just doing his best, perhaps with the right intentions, are we right to judge him so critically if we're, and actually he's just trying his best, like we try and do our best. Any thoughts?
Yeah, good question. I want to jump into the sympathizing with him piece, but I do feel like it was interesting. We don't know who wrote Jonah. My assumption is it's probably not Jonah himself because it's a pretty scathing review of him. He looks like an idiot, but some or either that or he's very humble to use himself as an example of his failures there. The way the author writes the book, though, does put Jonah in a pretty bad light. And one of the schemes they use is like sarcasm. I forget the right term for it, but it's kind of a way to mock Jonah. I mean, they just make him look really stupid all throughout, like him trying to run away from God. Like, you can't run away from God. Like, that's impossible. To him, like, caring so much about a plant. He wants to die because a plant, you know, dies.
He's been quite melodramatic.
Yeah, he's swallowed by a fish, which is just like this ridiculous thing. The end of the book of Jonah, actually the very last word is cow in Hebrew, where God is talking about being compassionate for the Ninevites, the 120,000 people, and then also for the animals. But the word's actually cow. So all throughout the book of Jonah, the author's trying to use this humor to kind of get us like mocking and laughing. And he's kind of trying to flip it. He's basically trying to have you get self-righteous about Jonah and be like, what a complete idiot. Like, doesn't he get it? He's so dumb. He tries to run from God. He's just far different than God in his mercy. And then with those last three questions, like, is it right for you to be angry? Is it right for you to be angry about the plant? And then God's last question, which is like, shouldn't I have concern for the Ninevites, the great city of Nineveh, these 120,000 people? The author's flipping it on you to be like, you've been laughing at Jonah, but really, you got to think about yourself in a way, which is like, hey, you should be sympathizing with Jonah. And I think we should. We can get all high and mighty. We often do this. We read stories in the Bible about like David and Bathsheba. And we're like, what an idiot. Or Moses getting angry and striking a rock. Or Peter, you know, his silly denials, or and we can think like, man, I'm far better than these people.
But like, often, if I was in that situation, I would never do that, you know.
But you know, we can also be encouraged, like we are like these people. And I think in many ways the author wants us to identify us as Jonah. And I think you can read him sympathetically. You know, I talked in the message about how horrific Nineveh was. I think it's hard for us, and I tried to get into that. We're just talking about you know, some of the things we have experienced in our country with war and brutality to help us relate a little bit to that.
We'll get to that with the enemies a little bit later.
Okay.
It's interesting as you're talking, it reminds me of like the Emperor's New Clothes.
Okay.
That story.
Yep.
And I don't think I've ever read the story because they're using a lot of humor.
Satire, that's the word I was looking for earlier.
On the king who's like, I'm on this new clothes, or the tailor's kind of making fun of him because he doesn't have any self-awareness. But we don't really have like, what caused him to have such little self-awareness? What caused Jonah to be so hurt and angry? And you mentioned like Nineveh being such an awful place. And I think we're so, we've been in, I know there's still wars that happen. Mm-hmm. But there's not, war and even death generally is quite sanitized and we're disconnected mm-hmm. from it. So when it comes to understanding the chaos and the violence of war, we're quite disconnected with it. Mm-hmm. But perhaps Jonah, now we don't know all the context, but the likelihood that he had to endure and witness some pretty horrific things makes sense that why he's actually angry. Yeah. You know, so you can see and understand why he's so.
One of my questions going into this was like, okay, if they were such like a, if they were their enemy, if they had actually, the kings had actually sent troops to fight in wars against them, one of the Israelite kings is, pictured as bowing down, King Jehu bowing down to King Shalmaneser. Like, I wouldn't just be like not wanting to go to them because they're my enemy and they've been brutal to so many people and even attacking Israel. I would be like scared for my life. We don't really capture that in the book. I did learn during this period, and I think you talked about this in the podcast, this is actually like a down period in the Assyrian Empire,
right?
Where there was famines. Mm-hmm. There was also a lot of like internal struggles within the government. And I think some of the kings were actually martyred by other people. Like there was like internal divisions. And so as they were experiencing like this down, like they were the largest kingdom in the world. And now right. they're like, not, they're struggling a little bit. You get Jonah coming in here marching. And so I think part of the reason that you see Assyria like respond so well is like, we're struggling, like, God, maybe you are real.
Right.
It was interesting. Last week, I was just kind of doing my normal Bible reading. Didn't even realize this was going to be tied to the message, but it was in 2 Chronicles, and the king of Assyria is like making his approach on Israel, and he is like, "Dude, you guys just bow down to me. Like, you guys are all gonna die, you know." And the king of Israel was like, "Don't worry about it. God's told me like we're gonna be fine. Like he's gonna defeat them." And so when the king of Assyria gets that message, he's like, "This is ridiculous. Like I've defeated all these other people and their God." So he comes kind of marching on his high horse, being like, "Dude, you guys are gonna eat it, and your God's gonna do nothing." And then all of a sudden, he's got conflict back home. He goes back home. He's killed by his own people. And so there's like this humbling of Assyria. This is at a different time period, but sure. you do see that. Trying to remember where we're going there with...
Well, it's interesting. I think what we see, to at least trying to view mm-hmm. Jonah through a little bit more of a compassionate mm-hmm. lens, yep. In Jonah... For is it, but it displeased Jonah. This was after God yep. showing his mercy, but it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at it compassionately, mm-hmm. he's actually, it seems like he has a strong justice bent.
Yeah,
like I would say I have quite a strong justice yep. bent. Like if something does someone wrong, like you should get yeah. what's coming to you. And mm-hmm. it irks me when justice is not given.
Yeah,
so. Some people have a high sense of justice that would probably resonate with Jonah, and he's angry, but he can't let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And this maybe is tied to, do you think his hatred for the Ninevites was warranted?
Definitely. I mean, to see their brutality, and even though, their history, I feel like you're rightful to be like, you're doing these kind of wicked things to people. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I do feel like we can... ridicule Jonah, but I think if we were in the same circumstances, we'd be like, no way, like yeah. this is not how we should respond. I think you brought up earlier, like we in modern America, we haven't experienced like wars on our territory. I mean, the closest to that is either like terrorist attack, like the 9/11 attacks, or some random things like the Boston Marathon. I mentioned that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last time I preached. So there's a little bit, but it's not like this close to home thing where we see like war enemies. Mm-hmm. I do feel like depending on where you live and your socioeconomic level, like you might experience less violence around you or more violence. So There's plenty of people who might be listening to this that like you see a lot of violence around you, mm-hmm. and you do feel like fear, or you do feel like you've got people who you're angry about, you feel threatened by. So you could maybe associate more closely
right.
with Jonah, even in your current living situation.
This is a really good point. I want to hit on that topic on who is our enemy. Because mm-hmm. I think we've got quite a wide spectrum. On one end, we have people who are, I mean, you in your message kind of talked on the enemies of our of war. So mm-hmm. ISIS being one. This is mm-hmm. They are shouting death to America. Like, it's quite clear that they are against mm-hmm. America. But then you also have like your neighbor, and we're to have show grace and mercy to our neighbor and show grace and mercy. And it's like this wide spectrum where, yeah, we have a neighbor, but we, to your point, we don't really have that close, depending on where you might live or mm-hmm. circumstances, like you say, we might not have a context for that violence mm-hmm. that he's referencing. Mm-hmm. So help us kind of define who our enemy is.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to look a little bit, you know, different for all of us. You know, when I first moved into my house 5 years ago, I started listening to a book called The Gospel Comes with a House Key by Rosaria Butterfield. She was a former English literature head of women's studies professor at Syracuse University. She was a lesbian. She kind of looked at Christians, as her enemies, and then received a thoughtful letter to an editorial she wrote by a pastor who started to meet with her, connect with her, have meals with her. Eventually, she came to the place where she believed, like, even though it really, she struggled with it, like, I believe that Jesus actually existed. He died, he's buried, he rose again, he died for me. Wow. And so she placed her faith in him, and then her life began to conform more into what Jesus would teach about biblical morality. And so she started following Jesus. And out of that, she, you know, a lot of people can look at people of other sexual orientations or worldviews as the enemy. But she's like, man, we need to love everyone. And her whole focus of the gospel comes with a house key is loving your neighbors, like your actual neighbors. And so she was really intentional about building relationships with the people in her neighborhood, inviting them over on like the Nextdoor app, doing meals every day, even like reading scripture and praying. And people were like, this is kind of weird. Like, but they would be so loved by her that they felt like this is a safe place. And there was one person in their neighborhood who like everyone like didn't like, because there was like weird stuff going on around the house. Like the cops would show up. They wondered if there's like drugs going on. And they kind of befriended him. He had like this mean, vicious dog, but they would like one day they went to help him find this dog. Like none of the other neighbors would help. And he was like, wow, these people care for me. And then eventually one day, like there was like a, I don't know if it was like a meth bust, whatever, like on the home. And so all the neighbors are like scoffing, like, yeah, this is what we knew. But they knew the guy, you know? And so they had enough relationship to love and care for him. So I think sometimes we can have actual neighbors who are like, we just see things where like, I don't want to go near them. Like, got to protect my kids, protect my family. And so we can just resist even going because they're different. There's other neighbors who are like, oh yeah, our kids are the same. They're nice kids. Let's play together. Mm-hmm. They share the same political views. Their house signs or their political signs in their yard are the same ones that we would, you know, put in our yard maybe. And so that we would feel like, oh yeah, I can associate with them. So I think we can look at our actual neighbors as enemies or friends. So that's one answer into who are our enemies. I think we can dive more into that.
But. Sure. Even in the Greek, the term, when Jesus was like, love your enemies, mm-hmm. Pray for them. The term in the Greek is really to do with like hostile foe, people who are opposing you. Even to the point of someone who's actively out against you. And there's quite a wide spectrum of that, where someone who, without getting too black and white on it, someone who's not necessarily for you, kind of like the neighbor you were describing from the book, they weren't for the other neighbors. They were just quite, it sounds like they were quite aggravated or maybe not hostile in an mm-hmm. active way, but in a very passive, maybe a passive aggressive yeah. way, that would probably fall under like enemy. They're not really for you.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Israel and them being too ethnocentric, because yeah. I think this plays into it too.
Yeah, I mean, we see all throughout the scriptures this kind of isolationism of Israel. Like, they were God's chosen nation, and so they wore that as a badge of honor. And they almost looked at it as like, God chose us and not you. So mm-hmm. like, let's just focus on ourselves. Let's be faithful to God. Like, you know, we have the clean people, and we're the clean people. You're the unclean. Like, we can't touch you. We can't be around you. Even like Peter, he like, oh boy, I don't want to eat with these people. Like, I might become dirty or ceremonially unclean. So there was a theme throughout the scriptures of Israel, kind of like thinking, you know, us against them. But we see right from like Genesis 12, when God first chooses Abraham, who, you know, Israel is a descendant of Abraham. There's Abraham, Isaac, he has Isaac, and then Isaac has Jacob. Jacob's name is changed to Israel. That's where the nation of Israel comes from. But in Genesis 12:3, God says, I'm choosing you, and I promise you you land. I'm going to give you like some territory. I'm going to promise you a seed, like you're going to have children. Eventually that seed is going to be like Jesus, our rescuer. Mm-hmm. But then also blessing. He's going to bless you, and then he says you're going to be a blessing to the nation. So mm. right from the beginning, God choosing Israel, like, their purpose wasn't just God saving them, but God through them blessing the world, saving the world. The Messiah, the rescuer, comes through them, but they continue to forget that. And then even in the New Testament, you just see like there's this, here's our enemies. You have the zealots, you know, yeah. who are like ready to take out Rome, who's in authority. And Jesus on the cross, you know, says, Father, forgive them. You know, they know not what to do. He was you know, forgiving his enemy. And I shared in the message, his Sermon on the Mount, like, people say, love your friends and hate your enemies, but I say, love your enemies and pray uh-huh. for those who persecute you. So yeah. then there's the Great Commission. Like, Jesus' last, like, parting words to his people is, like, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. Like, mm-hmm. so our mission is to go to the whole nations. In Romans, the book of Romans, Paul is writing. And when Paul began his ministry, he'd always go into cities. He was a Jew. He was a Jewish scholar. He was a Pharisee. The way he did evangelism, he'd go into the synagogue, and he would open up the scriptures and try to share who Jesus was. And he did that a lot, but then he started getting a lot of Jewish people like saying, you're crazy, we're going to try to kill you. And so he kind of wipes his hands of them. And in Acts 13, we see the shift in the book of Acts. Now he's going from Israel to going to the Gentiles, to the rest of the nations. And so when he's writing this letter to Jews in Rome, in Romans 1:16, he talks about how the gospel goes first to the Jew and then to the Gentile. And he's not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of salvation for everyone who believes. So the whole flow of scripture, yeah. I mean, even you get to Revelation and you see people from every tribe, tongue, nation, mm-hmm. Worshiping God together. And so we can get into our own little bubble of like, it's Christians against the world, or yeah, we yeah. can even get into like, it's America against the world, similar to how Jonah would be like, it's Israel against the enemies, the rest right. of the world.
That's so interesting that I think as you look back, and because God's wanting to create a holy people set apart for him, mm-hmm. it's how he's described Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But really the whole focus, as you say, is to be this sort of like city on a hill, mm-hmm. this light for the nations.
Yeah.
It's a model of what mm-hmm. could be. And that's N.T. Wright, I've quoted before, of he describes the church as being a model of the new creation. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, that's probably not quoting him directly, mm-hmm. but a small working model of the new creation.
Yeah.
And the, mm-hmm. the even the laws, the Ten Commandments, as we had a series mm-hmm. in the summer on yeah. the Ten Commandments, all of it was designed to show there's a better way.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, I think Jonah, what I'm hearing you say too is Jonah is stuck mm-hmm. in that ethnocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, no, it's actually about protecting the nation of Israel. Mm-hmm. We receive mercy. Mm-hmm. They don't get mercy yeah. because they're against us, but he's missing the point. that we shouldn't miss today, that the mercy that we've received is not to stay with us, but it's actually to outpour.
I was listening to a podcast this week, one that I love, is called Undeceptions. I'd encourage you to check it out. And the Great most podcast. Recent episode is on the persecution complex, where Christians have been persecuted, but there can be an unhealthy perspective in Christians where you're like, everyone is trying to persecute me. And sometimes we feel like people are trying to persecute us because we're being a jerk with how we're trying to proclaim Christianity. And so it's a wrong complex. And it also has a wrong mentality. Instead of us being like, let's get our enemies who are persecuting us, like Jesus said, we need to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So we have to make sure we don't have that ethnocentric mindset, or like if we are being reviled by our enemies, that we're not in turn reviling them.
Let's hit anger. Yep. So God says to him, I think on two occasions to Jonah, is it right for you to be angry? He's like, are you right to be angry at this? He's asking Jonah. Yep. And then later on is like, is it good for you to be angry at the plant? When is anger okay? Is it okay for Jonah to be angry here?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime there's evil that we experience, there is right to be angry. You quoted this in the first podcast in the series about how the author of Jonah uses the word ra, and it's kind of used for wickedness, evil, anger, from like the sea raging to how Jonah felt and God's even anger. But I think anytime we experience, whether it is evil in our world, like it's a storm, it's a natural disaster, we can feel almost an anger that this is so broken, all the way up to evil's done against people that we love, other people, and evil's done against us. I feel like any time we see that brokenness, it is justified to feel angry and even seethe in anger. In fact, I was just reading before this, thinking about this justified feeling. One of the things that we're probably not very good, and we've talked about this a little bit in over the last year at Northridge, is the idea of lament. And you see this all throughout the New Testament. I think it's in Psalm 137:9. Israel is in conflict with the Edomites. They've been like taken out of their own land, and they're so broken up about it that at the end they use just unimaginable language of like wanting such vengeance. They'd be like, they're going to feel good about dashing the Edomites' babies' heads against rocks. I mean, that is just appalling. That's but that's just showing like how much anger they felt because of the things that had been done against them. And the point of that passage isn't to say like that would be an okay thing to do, but to say sometimes we feel that angry in a justified way about the evils that are done.
Ephesians 4:26, be angry but do not sin. It seems like Jonah was somewhat justified. So God doesn't even say that he's justified or not in his anger. He's just posing the question to him, trying to prove a point. Obviously, I think when you look at the whole arc of it, he has an anger problem. Where is the point where anger becomes sin? And is the solution to our anger, you talk about lament, is lament the healthy way to resolve that anger, whether it is justified or not?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, one of the translation questions, and I really don't know what's a more faithful rendering and if it deal with this, some of the translations say, and maybe this is the ESV, God says, do you do well to be angry in those questions?
This is in Jonah, not in Ephesians.
Yeah, and do you do well to be angry about the plant? The NIV that we read is like, is it right for you to be angry? So there's only almost like two aspects there. Like right would be like, is this justified anger?
Right,
like,
or wrong?
That is right. You know, and I think you could say it in many situations, it is right. It is justified to be angry. I mean, God himself is the one who's going to bring judgment. He talks about the future judgment for all those reject him. In fact, we do see that not too long, I think it's in 622 BC, so this is happening 150 years after Jonah, Assyria will fall.
Right.
You know, their repentance is temporary, you know, and then God will judge them. trying to go with my train of thought here. So there's a right justification. There's also, do you do well to be angry? So you can say like, how's that working out for you? You're just so angry all the time.
Yeah.
It's just flowing out of you. Like if you're getting snarky with your family, if you just can't think about anything, what the evil's done to you, you might be in a place where your anger has moved beyond just justification to it's causing you to sin.
Yeah.
And I think even, you know, whether it's your struggles with political views or things that have been done to you, if you center so much of your time focusing on the evils, it's going to shape your heart in an unhealthy way. Even that's where Jesus says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. As you pray, I think God begins to change your heart. He says in Philippians 4:8, like, think about what is right, what is true, what is good, of good report. And so if all we're doing is filling our mind with news that is just inflaming our anger, like that might be a justified anger, but are you doing well to be angry?
Yeah.
Maybe it's causing you to sin and not be the merciful person that you need to be, like God is merciful.
So you mentioned lamenting as being a solution to your, effectively a way in which you can release the anger in a healthy way. It doesn't seem like Jonah did that at all. He just kind of reacted. And then we see the kind of melodramatic thing. And I think we see this even today of where anger, justified anger becomes sin when it spills over to the mundane things. Like the plant, this is God's mercy shown to Jonah. Yeah. And he's angry at the plant. He's just like, I'm annoyed at this. And then he, I think for us, it kind of blinds us to move us into the melodramatic that we say. It's like, I would rather die. I would rather like... chill out, dude. Like you're not actually dealing with it. And I think it's a lesson for us. I think we're God's showing us in Jonah how misplaced anger is not just bad for the mission but bad for us. It doesn't do as well to your point. It doesn't do as well. So it can, I found myself even driving in today and across the Bay Bridge. And there, I wasn't angry or anything like that, but I found myself as this car is coming back and I'm like, is that when you're heading west and I'm taking the exit just after and you see all the people that are trying to like get by and I'm like, you kind of start speeding up. I'm like, I'm not going to let them in. I'm not going to let them in. And I'm like, do I do well to be like that?
Yeah.
What benefit is it for me?
Yeah.
And I think that what that does is because it layers upon, because if I'm just going to be defensive like that, what's that going to show the other drivers?
Yeah.
And I think then we culturally, this undealt with anger seeps into all these other things. And it's not just bad for the mission, it's bad for us too.
I mean, Jonah really seems to me like a very depressed person. Like he wants to die. Like when he's on the boat, he says, like, just throw me over the seas. And part of that is he's rebelling against God. So when you're going against God, you're going to be struggling with some emotions because you know you're not where you need to be. He doesn't have the heart of God, so he's unmerciful. Yeah, and then again, it's just so crazy that God shows mercy, and his reaction in verse 3 of chapter 4 is like, I want to die. Just take my life now. You showed mercy. Like, I can't imagine mercy. The mercy is so like unimaginable to him. He just wants to no longer be alive. And then even just with the plant, it's like a plant is dying. I mean, I get it. Like 120 degrees is pretty hot.
That's
you hard. Might feel uncomfortable. But to get to the point of being like, I'm just ready to die. Like
after
that kinda,
just witnessing and being a tool of an incredible miracle. A whole city turning to God, including the authorities that be, and you're like, yeah, I just want to die. Like, it's, I mean, that's perhaps a hyperbole.
It almost reminds me of some of the religious leaders' response to like miracles, like Lazarus is raised from the dead.
Right.
And instead of them being amazed at that and what God is doing, they're like so focused on like, this isn't how it's supposed to do and how it's supposed to work. And I think you're obeying our rules, you know? So. Yeah.
I shared a story about Corrie Ten Boom in the beginning. In this incredible moment after she spoke a message, and there came up to her as this SS officer that was there at the concentration camp. Now, there's not many people that are experiencing the same level of horror. At least it's probably listening to this podcast. I'm not saying stuff like that doesn't happen anymore. But for the majority of our listeners, that's not really a reality where they're going to have to extend a hand and have to be bridged with that. I'm curious your thoughts on how she even described in her writing that anger that boiled up and then was overtaken by love. And it's an example of holding justice and mercy at the same time. How do we become more like Corrie to be able to hold justice and mercy seemingly opposing one another? How do we hold them at the same time?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's interesting in that moment you talk about how she, her thought goes back to not the harms done to her, but what Christ had done, you know, and that Christ died for him. And so that was the paradigm. You know, I think it's Ephesians 4:32, we forgive others because Christ has forgiven us. You know, why do we love? Because Christ first loved us. So I think if our hearts aren't daily, and this is a struggle, I mean, to daily marinate yourself in God's mercy toward you, then it's going to be hard to extend the mercy of God. You know, most of us, like, the kinds of enemies we have are a lot of them are going to be like with your own family members, the people you're living with, like the arguments that you have, the things they've done, the ways they've not treated you fairly, a way that a boss has overlooked you or a coworker seems to like ignore you, be partial to other people. Maybe it's, you know, a classmate at school, like people who like exclude you. Maybe they make fun of you and you just hold like this vitriol in your heart. You're like, I just don't like these people. You know, if they were to get fired from their job, you'd be like, yes, like so glad to see you, you pay. And those are most of the kind of the relationships, just the subtle digs and slights or mistreatment that in many ways we have to have our heart posture remembering God's grace so that we can be quick to forgive. Doesn't mean we ignore those problems. And in their situations where people need to face the legitimate, lawful consequences of their decisions and make sure that they're not going to put further harm on other people, like we do need to pursue righteousness and justice in those moments. But even at the same place, like one of the things in preparing for this message, I just heard like many stories of amazing ways, not just like Corrie Ten Boom, but years ago, there was like the Amish community who had a guy who went in and like shot up all these kids. And,
was this not recently?
I don't know, in the last 10, 15 years.
There's something happening very recently, but go on.
So, you know, this guy went in and shot up all these kids in a school, just a horrific thing. And they think he took his own life. But the Amish community came, and when that guy was like, the court scene was there, the family, the Amish family stood in front of the mother, the wife of this person so that she wouldn't be caught on camera. They extended Christ's forgiveness, and then they even pooled funds together to pay for this guy's kid's future, like college expenses, extending the mercy of God to such injustice that had been done. Like what an unimaginable thing to do. But I think when we marinate our hearts in the gospel and see how merciful God has been to us, we are able to then extend that mercy.
I just watched a similar story of this Australian guy who the family lost four children to this drunk driver. And the guy, he's doing, I mean, he was 18, 19, something like that, lost his sister, became very depressed, again, was doing his best with how, with what he knew how, and he was drunk behind the wheel and crashed into four kids and they died. And this family, and you hear this every so often of remarkable times like this, where they forgive the guy that killed your kids. And because of that, he came to know Jesus. Mm. And it's amazing how we love hearing those stories. We love, but it was still hard in this interview for them to sit next to each other. He was like, it's never easy. Mm-hmm. I think about my kids, but he has an understanding. The father has an understanding mm-hmm. of the mercy he's received mm-hmm. and knows that this other guy mm-hmm. Needs the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think just practically, like, within your own family, you know, tensions, whether it's like marital, like marriages don't have to end in divorce. Like there is, I'm not saying that, you know, there are biblical grounds for divorce, but I think sometimes there can be reconciliation that's possible if we truly understand fully the grace of God and we're willing to work through those issues and extend that mercy. So, I mean, it gets complicated,
yeah.
But there's healing and there's relationships that can be repaired.
There's, in holding justice and mercy at the same time, I think we see in Jonah the need to trust God with the justice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really hard to do when something has been wronged to you mm-hmm. or your people, or the justified know there needs to be justice done for these wrong acts. Mm-hmm. But when God wants to actually use you to show his mercy at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you see that with God still showing Jonah mercy, not just to the Ninevites, mm-hmm. but to him by the plan. And it mm-hmm. seems like that's the underscore of trust me. Mm-hmm. Like I'm still just when, even though I want to show mercy, mm-hmm. because as you mentioned later on, the Assyrians mm-hmm. are destroyed. In some ways, justice still came mm-hmm. way after Jonah's time. Mm-hmm. And I think when it comes to us, we want to be the arbiters of justice. Mm-hmm. We want to take it into our own hands. Jonah, I think, wanted to show or to have justice by not being the arbiter of the mercy God mm-hmm. wants to do. He mm-hmm. wants to take on justice. And mm-hmm. I don't, maybe you, this is me just thinking out loud, but I don't see it ever that we are to be the ones to bring justice.
Yeah. What do they call that? Like taking the law into your own hands. Right. You know, some of us, you know, you might be a lawyer, you might be a sure. law enforcement, you work for the government, you're a judge, you're a prosecutor. Like we might have, you know, roles to take in doing that.
That are needed.
And even if you're not in one of those roles, like if you see something wrong, say something, you know, like we need to speak the truth. We need to pursue righteousness and justice. And so we don't ignore, look over problems and just be like, God's merciful, so we're just going to be merciful. Like we pursue justice fully while extending a heart posture of grace and personal forgiveness toward people where you could pursue that reconciliation. Maybe not the relationship is like it was before,
of course,
but you're not harboring ills anymore. So I think that is
in that
possible.
In this story in Australia where the guy killed this guy's four kids, he said this, which really struck me. He said, justice is not for me, it's for the community. Mm-hmm. This guy being in jail for killing mm-hmm. my kids does not make me feel better. Mm-hmm. It's for the community to show that this was wrong.
Yeah.
And I found that really compelling for some mm-hmm. reason. I was like, for him to not just be like, yeah, he's getting what he deserves. Mm-hmm. And the guy who killed the kids, like he was like, I deserve this. Mm-hmm. I'm paying, I accept it. Mm-hmm. But the dad's like, he's not saying he doesn't deserve it, but it's like, it doesn't do anything for me. Mm-hmm. I'm still grieving. I'm still hurting. Yeah. It's 5 years ago. But justice is not for me. It doesn't bring my kids back.
Yeah. I think one of the most beautiful things about Christianity being true is that, like, if there is no God, then there really is no justice. Like in the course of history, you know, 500, 1,000, a million years from now, like all of this that has existed will all just go into infinity, everything will evaporate, die. It would be nothingness if there is no God. And really, then there would be no ultimate justice. You know, for people who went to their grave, horrible criminals who experienced the best of the best in life, they never had to pay. But with God, there is the reality of true and final justice. God is going to bring justice against, he's going to right every wrong. And so we can find security in that future justice. And ultimately, there is the justice that God speaks. He's the just one and the justifier. I think that's the language used, I think it's in Romans, about what Christ has done. I mean, you think about if anyone should be ready to pass vengeance and angry. It's God who created us and we rebelled and he sends his son to rescue us and we reject him and we kill him. He's like, I'm coming to you to rescue you. You just got to believe in me and we kill you. Mm-hmm. And so like he should be vengeful and just like, you're going to pay. But on the cross, he says, Father, forgive them for they know what to do. And then he takes the justice. He receives the punishment that we deserve. I mean, that's the heart of Christianity. Yeah. When that truth, when we fully comprehend it and it seeps down into our hearts, then it does change our posture. And then, you know, I shared that quote from Brian Laritz, unmerciful Christian is an oxymoron of treasonous proportions.
Say like, that again.
An unmerciful Christian is an oxymoron of treasonous proportions. Until we understand the mercy of God and learn to extend that to others, then we haven't fully understood what Christ has done for us.
I want to get practical, but I also want to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think that there's the big brushstroke, big picture message here is about showing mercy to mm-hmm. those that don't deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, I think of people who have suffered some pretty horrific things
mm-hmm.
and a level of abuse that we're not saying, yeah, they have done something really wrong to you and therefore you need to go and share the love of Jesus with them.
Mm-hmm.
That may be what God calls someone to do.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of similar in that situation with Corrie ten Boom.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to be very careful not to just send a message of put yourself in harm's way again, mm-hmm. or put yourself in a situation where you either are going to be angry and sin,
mm-hmm.
or you... it is just not helpful or healthy for you in any way. I think I want to be clear on that because I think we can be easily like show the love of Jesus. Yeah. It's kind of a happy message, but there's some real things that people go through. I have like three people in my mind right now
mm-hmm.
that I for those who are listening to just be very careful with that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there's a mandate to love our enemies, pray for those who persecute you, mm-hmm. is the words of Jesus.
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated in, you know, some of those situations where we don't want to put ourselves in further harm to return to our abuser to make things worse.
Mm-hmm.
What I do want to say to that, though, is like there's incredible like emotional and psychological damage that many people wrestle with that. And it's, you know, to a degree, it feels like, is it possible to ever get past this? Like, is this just going to consume me the rest of my life? I think that's a hard thing to recover from. It is a slow process. But I do think with Christ and with the gospel, there is a level of healing that can happen. Where instead of you being consumed with anger and vengeance at all times to the point where it cripples you in life, I think similar to Corrie ten Boom, there is a freedom that the gospel can bring even in your own soul. as you wrestle through those past circumstances.
Can I just make a slight distinction? Because I heard this recently and I can't remember where, so I'm sorry I don't have the credit, but there's a difference between healing and redeeming. Mm-hmm. Healing is like nothing ever happened. Mm-hmm. Redeeming is still broken, but you're free from it. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we talk in terms of healing like it never happened, mm-hmm. and it is not helpful for long-term mm-hmm. wounds mm-hmm. that need to be healed.
Yeah,
could be Jonah. There was some long-term brokenness there mm-hmm. that he was not healed. Mm-hmm. And some people, it's not about finding healing, but they're finding redemption. They're finding freedom mm-hmm. yeah. in the midst of that. So I want to just make that distinction.
Yeah.
So how do we share? How do we show that mercy?
Yeah, I mean, I think there, you know, when it comes to like direct enemies and being hurt by people, I think there is pursuing justice and righteousness while also being willing to extend forgiveness in our hearts to someone and even say, I will forgive you as they ask for forgiveness, to extend that to them. Then I think there's just also God's commission to go to the nations and bring the gospel. God told Jonah to go to his enemy. I think we can focus so much, like, I love this as a church. Our church is very focused on making more and better followers of Jesus. And we're very focused on our Rochester community, our Webster, Brighton, our city. And I think rightfully so. Like, when Jesus kind of gave his final words, he said, you go to Jerusalem and then Judea and then the uttermost parts of the earth. And so we definitely need to go local and share the gospel with the people right around us. I don't feel like, we rarely talk about go to the uttermost parts of the earth, go to a foreign nation. There are, you know, many people.
I think I've got that down. As a foreigner. Yeah,
coming from Scotland to the threatening country of America. But there are people that God does call to go to places in the Middle East, to go to Muslim-controlled territory where they're they're concerned for their own life. Like, some of the seminary students I went to were former Muslims in Africa and mm-hmm. India. They converted to Christianity. And one of them, I get these regular emails from. He's in the middle of like a Muslim-controlled part of Africa, and he's like, yeah, we had to flee our town today, the Christian school that I'm a president of. We had to shut our doors. Like, he's facing that persecution. He's bringing the gospel. He's going to his own people.
Yeah.
But I do would love for people to consider, even in their own hearts, like, we want to go to our own people, but could God potentially be, even now as you listen to this, calling you to go to people who have never heard the gospel in a foreign land and share your faith? For most of us, though, like, we have our day-to-day needing to share our faith. And so that can look really complicated. Like, some of us, like, I was talking with community group this last week. One of the questions was, like, how do you talk about hard truths? So, like, we were talking about God, Jesus talks about hell. Like, how do I bring up hell to my friend, my neighbor, my coworker? Like,
it's an interesting place to start.
Yeah, so maybe that's not the place that you start.
Right.
But what does that actually look like? So for years, we have said, like, Northridge's outreach strategy isn't to do events. You know, we're not going to, like, do some big concert or thing where you're going to come in and then we're going to preach the gospel and then hopefully they'll be saved. The closest thing to that is like Sunday morning, you know, coming here. But really, our outreach strategy is you. It's me. It's like God has given us the need to share the gospel. And how do we even begin? So we've talked about pray, invest, invite. Like, it starts with praying. Like, if you're not regularly, every day praying for people, then one, your heart's not going to be in a place where you're like thinking, I need to share my faith. But when you pray every day, one, you're thinking of, if you have specific people in your mind that you're praying for every day, then you're going to be thinking about it. Like, as you rub shoulders with them, you're like, I've been praying for this person. You're more inclined to actually begin to share with them. The second part of that is invest. So it's like, maybe you're like doing a loop around your neighborhood and you're praying for houses as you go along. And maybe you know some of the people, maybe you don't. if all you do is pray and you never connect with them,
yeah.
you know, then that's a problem. So you need to take that step of investing. You know, maybe that someone moves into the neighborhood and you bring them food, you know, you get to know your neighbor and they lose their mom, you know, or, and then you like bring them flowers, or you invite people over into your home. You do a neighborhood block party. You connect with your coworkers and like, hey, let's go out for dinner tonight. You go to their daughter's play, you know, something where you're building a relationship. I've been thinking about this recently. You know, we do like big series like Christmas at the Movies, like we're doing this year, or other series, and I want to invite my neighbors. And how many of people have I invited to church, but have never invited into my own home? Mm. Like, how likely are they going to come to church
right.
if they don't even feel comfortable coming to my house? You know, and I'm not saying like, I don't want you to think, oh, well, I got to stop inviting people unless I've had them over to my house. Like, we can still do that. But part of that is like, I need to like actually build a relationship enough to like hear them, hear their thoughts.
Conversely, I think people are more comfortable just inviting people into church than inviting them into their own home.
Yeah. And yeah, different so people like, in different situations might be feel more comfortable walking into a church building than the intimacy of a home.
Yeah.
Other people might feel more comfortable walking into the intimacy of a home and like scared to death or like worried about walking into a church. So you got to kind of read the relationship.
It's good.
Well, the last part is the invite part. This is where like we get really scared. Like, what if they ask all these questions? I don't know the answer. Like I'm stumped, you know, like, what about creation versus evolution? Or how do you know God? Why Jesus and not all the other religions in the world? I mean, is Jesus really God? And we were like, I don't know how to answer those questions. Well, a good thing is like, those are need to know, need to grow moments. Like you can be like, I remember I heard a sermon about that once, or my pastor talked about that. You can go to your pastor, you can go to a community group leader, you can come to Northridge, you can go to our Exploring Faith class, you can get answers to those questions.
I don't know, let's figure it out together.
Yeah, but often, like instead of us worrying about having all the right answers, part of like inviting is first inviting other people to share their story. Like, hey, like, have you ever been to church before? Like, what is your religious view? Like, you kind of hear, if you start and ask someone like, hey, what is your faith background or what do you believe about God? A good chance is that eventually be like, well, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And then you can begin to dialogue. Now, sometimes that's a hard, like, where do you even start that initial question about God or about faith? You know, so you're going to try to find commonalities. At some point, though, you just need to, you know, figure out a way to bring that in. And maybe the easiest invite is to an invite to church, and then they go there, and then they hear the gospel, and then you can talk more about those things.
Sure.
I shared with my group, I don't remember where I heard this. Sometime in the last 6 months, there was a person that felt convicted. And I often fall into these shoes of like, I've had this relationship with a friend for a really long time. I've never talked with them about the gospel to a point where it feels a little bit weird. Like now I'm going to bring this up. And like, I don't know, like, but I just felt like God is telling me I need to share with them like everything I believe. And so they're like, I'm super nervous how this is going to go. But they called their friend and said, hey, I just want to get together with you and share with you about my faith. Like, are you okay with doing that? And they said, yes. And they're like, oh, okay, all right, here we go. So they're going to go in, they sit down, and he does his best job to like explain Christianity and the gospel. And the guy there decided to place his faith in Jesus, and he was so scared of doing that, which I think so many of us were scared to actually have those direct conversations, not knowing what God's going to do. And maybe they're going to blow us off. Maybe it's going to go really unwell, but maybe, just maybe, God might use you to lead that person to place their faith in Christ.
I think for some, they're probably, I am not ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
And those are amazing stories. I think what might be some helpful questions, if you want to bridge something, is what's your relationship been like with the church?
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. I asked a question similar to that with my neighbor, who is my golf partner on my golf trip. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that he grew up in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And then during college, it kind of fell out. So we actually had a really good conversation. So it doesn't have to be, what do you think about Jesus? Mm-hmm. Or very much, I think when we say share our faith, mm-hmm. it doesn't always mean that we have to have like a presentation or a message mm-hmm. prepared mm-hmm. to give to someone.
Mm-hmm.
But get curious.
Yeah.
Have I'm curious, like I believe in Jesus, but what do you think about Jesus? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be this sort of direct, putting someone on the spot, but get curious. Yeah. Like, what is behind? Because there's oftentimes a lot of background. There's a lot of people that grew up in the church that had a very complicated relationship with the church, with the Bible, with God, that you might just be kind of barging yourself into and have no idea. And then on the other side, someone might have never even heard of Jesus. That's a growing reality.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with the church? What's your perception of Christians?
Yeah.
That'd be another great question to ask. So hopefully those are some good handholds for our listeners. And as you wrap up, if this episode or if there's been episodes in this series that have meant something to you, or maybe you actually want to have a conversation with maybe someone in your small group or someone like a spouse or a friend that you've been talking to, like, how do we share our faith? What's up with Jonah? Share the episode with them. I think it'd be a really easy way. It's like, curious your thoughts on this. Yeah. I do that all the time. I think I've shared, we've gone back and forth. You shared an Undeceptions episode with me. But next week, we are starting a new series. We wrap up Jonah. We're starting a new series, which I'll be honest, I've been looking forward to this for months. We're talking about spiritual maturation, spiritual maturity. How do we grow in our faith? What is growing even about? And I think we talk about discipleship, we talk about being part of the church and membership and getting involved, but what does it actually mean to grow, to become more like Jesus? That's next week on A Little Better. But remember, you become a little better, we become a little better when we love God and love others a little better. Hope to see you next week.